This is the Advanced Allied Command Post. American war correspondent Stanley Richardson has just returned from the second front beachhead with the first naval eyewitness of the operation. Mr. Richardson.
I've just returned from the channel approaches to the coast of France, where I was privileged to watch the opening phases of the largest scale military invasion operation in history. My ringside seat was the heaving deck of a United States Naval Patrol torpedo boat on which I traveled across the channel with the first contingents of a naval task force. This force was composed mostly of American units. From the time we left the British coast until we were within a short 2 or 3 miles of the French shore, our naval units encountered no enemy opposition whatsoever. That, perhaps, is the outstanding fact that I brought back with me. Altogether, my squadron of PT boats was in the channel for about 20 hours. We covered scores of square miles of rolling, choppy sea. We were patrolling and acting as escort for literally hundreds of slower-moving vessels of all descriptions. Many of them had been at sea longer than we had, but the Germans either were taken completely by surprise or just were afraid to come out and challenge us. Not a recognizable enemy plane appeared overhead. At least no bombs were dropped at or on any of the ships in our area. No low-flying fighters came over to strafe us with machine gun fire. And no enemy vessel, not even one of their vaunted E-boats, came out to the attack. The officers and men with whom I rode wondered searchingly about this. They had been keyed up for some real German opposition, both from the air and the sea. Their trigger fingers were itching for a scrap, and they were a very disappointed lot at not getting it. If the Germans weren't just too timid to come out, the only other ready explanation that could be advanced was that they were too busily engaged in coping with the Allied air attacks made on their shore establishments as a prelude to the actual landing of troops. In the area we covered, we could see hundreds of bombers and fighters shuttling back and forth, dropping their bomb loads and returning to England for more explosives to blast the enemy. And we could see the big two-engined American transport planes, also in the hundreds, returning to their bases in the United Kingdom after dropping their airborne troops in France. Yes, Jerry had a lot to keep him busy last night and early today, but as far as the naval phase of our activity was concerned, not a shot was exchanged with the enemy while I was on the scene. For that preliminary phase of the show, at any rate, it was all too incredibly easy. We left our patrol torpedo boat base in daylight to accompany the slow-moving light advance guard of ships, which had to pave the way for the actual landing. One of our missions was to protect the Allied minesweepers, which cleared a wide channel straight to the enemy shore for our troop transports and supply ships. Long lines of ships of every description were discernible on the skyline. Literally miles of craft in even columns converging upon the area in the channel marked for the concentration point for the actual invasion. Huge transports, tank landing ships, smaller troop landing craft, tankers and supply vessels of every kind plodded doggedly along under lowering skies and laboring over heavy seas. You people at home would have been thrilled to the bone to have seen all these American men, American ships, and American supplies sailing calmly into the action for which they had been prepared and trained for so many months. It was estimated that there were more than 4,000 ships of all kinds in the channel for this combined operation. By nightfall, we were nearing the French coast and our watch tightened. But nothing happened. Even when a full, near moon, appearing fitfully from behind the clouds, gave our position away clearly to any enemy who may have been lying in wait for us. Then the fast and heavy combat ships moved up into position. All aligned themselves in the bombardment area to loose a hail of high explosives to protect the troops moving into the beaches on their landing craft. The warships started laying their smoke screen preparatory to shooting their guns. It was within only a few minutes of H hour of the long-awaited D-Day. And right there was where I got the biggest disappointment of my life. We turned around and headed back at high speed for the English coast. Our PT squadron was under orders to return to base and refuel for another mission as soon as its first operation was completed. So I didn't even hear the bombardment begin. But I can tell you that if things are going as well now as they look to be going at the time I left the scene, it won't be long before our troops have a firm foothold. And now here is Merrill Muller at the advanced command post of the Allied forces.
This is Merrill Muller reporting from the advanced Allied command post of the invasion forces. Operations toward the liberation of Europe commenced just a few hours ago. Thousands of ships, both in the air and on the sea, and armies of men are in motion fighting the greatest military amphibious undertaking in history. The whole thing started moving when one man pressed a theoretical button some hours ago. That man was the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who thinks of himself modestly as a Kansas farmer. Every evening, General Eisenhower gathered his staff around him in this secret headquarters, studied their faces, and asked their opinions. A gale had already roughened the channel, but the staff was confident on the winds, tide, and weather of today suiting an amphibious assault upon Europe. That was it. General Eisenhower wished his commanders luck, and the great undertaking then and there began to unfold. The finest collection of military minds in the United Nations had created a plan they considered complete. Every possible contingency had been thought of. A tremendous mass of the greatest military equipment ever devised had been pooled by the Allied attacking forces. A bombardment, the likes of which the world has never seen, was ready to open. Everything that could humanly be done had been done up to the point when General Ike pushed the button. The campaign thus passed to the direction of God and the hands of the common soldier. Early Monday morning, as the huge invasion force made last-minute preparations, General Eisenhower checked his decision again with his staff. The word was still go. Good weather was the prediction for H hour, D day. The dominating air support depends on good weather even more than the Allied navies. While landing craft of all types swung in and out of convoys to check their loadings and replace used fuel, General Eisenhower was busy doing the things he wanted to do, the only things he could do, visit his troops. As H hour, D day approaches, there is nothing more tactically useless than a supreme commander, except as an inspiration. General Ike is certainly that. I have never seen him more popular with his troops. I have never seen any commander receive greater acclaim or buoy his men more than does General Eisenhower. One British battalion cheered him as they clanked aboard their fast landing barge. He waved a friendly hello, and that broad grin lit up his face, a face that showed nothing but confidence in his men, a face in which fatigue is miraculously erased whenever it mirrors the Allied esprit de corps and the fighting spirit of the little men with rifle and bayonet. He came back from the port full of a sense of victory. No finer force ever went into battle with a better spirit or with greater courage than this one that General Eisenhower heads. In visiting with Royal and American Navy landing craft and with the Allied troops they will carry, the general had been given a lift. Some of his own nervous tension had been relieved. So he arrived at our hidden camp to meet the four correspondents attached to his staff. If I never attend another press conference in my life, I shall certainly remember this one. Perhaps because its outstanding factor was that it was more like a staff conference than a general's talk to newspapermen. Here's the picture. Remember that all around us, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men were readying themselves for the outbreak of the battle that all the world had waited for four long, dark years. Men from the far corners of the world ready to erase the stain of Dunkirk, to lift the shrouds of Nazi tyranny, to crush the Axis in the growth of the United Nations. Aeroplanes growled overhead. Ships were gathering and steaming off into the channel, and final road convoys rumbled into the embarkation areas. We all sprawled around the general's private field office and were given the picture. In a tiny tent, some 15 feet square, we sat and listened to the most amazing delivery of dynamic facts I have ever heard. We overcrowded and spilled half out of the tent onto its backyard concrete terrace. It is a modest office. The inner wall of the tent is half lined from the ground up with slats from packing cases. And some ingenious sergeant has stained those slats into imitation pine paneling. The floor is concrete with a couple of rope rugs. There's one desk, a telephone, two chairs, and a moderate wall map. Otherwise, the tent's show is the tree-shaded terrace and three pieces of deck chair furniture. You have to tear your eyes from the general to note these things because he holds your interest completely. when you appreciate his tremendous command of facts and figures, duplicated, I think, only by General Marshall, you understand why he was picked for this assignment. It is not opportune to release the details of our briefing on behalf of the general, except in three general ways. One, he wanted all the credit for this campaign to go to the common soldiers of the Allied armies, and he emphasized the lower ranks and the word Allied. His order of the day takes that vein. Two, he had nothing but praise for the untiring efforts and inexhaustible research of his various staffs and his various commanders for air, sea, armies, and supplies. Three, as to the actual plan itself, perhaps I can best put it this way. I have been in on all of General Eisenhower's amphibious assaults, but none was as involved or as mammoth as this one.
And here, word for word, is CBS correspondent Hotelet's description of the scene off the French coast on D-Day, shortly before H hour. By this time, it was getting on, and the sun was painting the sky a bright orange color on our left. Below us, the English Channel was a fine, deep blue. There were a few white caps, but the impression was that it wasn't very rough down below. About 5 miles off the French coast, we saw planes in a steep dive laying a smoke screen. Just about the same minute, the pilot said he saw the fires on the shore. I looked hard as I could, and there, down to the left, were some naval vessels. They looked like cruisers firing broadsides onto the shore. Near the cruisers were dozens of landing craft of all kinds, hardly visible in the early morning haze. All this while we saw medium bombers and fighters crisscrossing on the way to the targets without a sign of a German plane. And then we turned over the coast about 10 miles, and 10 minutes before H hour, we saw a fast assault boat race along parallel to the beach, laying a smoke screen. From the way the screen lay, smooth and even, it looked as if there were no wind. And Hotelet concluded, the circumstances of our flight make it impossible to draw any far-reaching conclusions on how the battle is going, but one thing we can say already, and that is, our air supremacy over the coastal invasion zone is not seriously challenged. Correspondent Herbert M. Clark, speaking over a pooled network of all major United States radio chains, spoke in praise of Allied security measures. He said, the place we've picked for our main landing is one Jerry hadn't figured on. The Nazis have been badly outguessed on this whole show. It's going to be surprised by the direction of the attack, and he is going to get a shock from the timing. The master race has fallen down again. Another Allied correspondent heard on Columbia this morning was James Willard, also speaking for the pooled networks. Willard declared that thousands of Allied planes had been at work all night softening up the invasion coast. Said Willard, already several thousand paratroopers are waiting further inland to join forces with the landing parties. These airborne troops were flown in last night. Willard also commented on the amazing quietness of the scene along the strip of territory directly behind the invasion beaches. He declared that with the exception of a German tank moving up the road toward the beachhead or hiding in hedges, he could see no sign of enemy resistance. As to those Allied paratroopers now disrupting German defenses behind the front, Allied correspondent Wright Bryan, who accompanied them on their flight, says they met only scattered small arms fire from the fields. Bryan has been living with a unit of paratroopers for some time. He reports that yesterday afternoon, General Eisenhower visited the camp, passing quietly among the men and chatting with them. Bryan says the men were trained to the utmost and fully ready for action. And here is his description of what happened in his plane as it flew over France. The senior officer on board moved quietly up and down the passenger compartment, speaking to each man and asking if he had everything he needed. As the men settled back into their seats, Colonel Cole said, "There's a doc who's going to give you some pills to guard against air sickness. Make yourselves as comfortable as you can, and you'd better try to sleep a little." And then quiet settled over the plane. These men had done their talking. Now they were grim and silent. Later on, correspondent Bryan said, "I walked down the long passenger cabin to see how the paratroopers were riding. More than half of them had taken their colonel's advice and were dozing with their heads back against the wall and their feet stretched out in front of them. The others were sitting silently, except for two or three who talked among themselves in whispers." And a broadcast an hour ago from somewhere on the English coast, in it, another reporter for the radio pool, Stanley Richardson, gave an eyewitness account of the naval action that prepared the way for the landings. As far as the naval phase of our activity was concerned, he said, "Not a shot was exchanged with the enemy while I was on the scene. For that preliminary phase of the show, at least, it was all too incredibly easy. We left our patrol torpedo boat in daylight to accompany the slower-moving light advance guard of ships which had to pave the way for the actual landings. One of our missions was to protect the Allied minesweepers, which cleared a wide channel straight to the enemy shore for our troops, transports, and supply ships. Long lines of ships of every description were discernible on the skyline, literally miles of craft in even columns converging upon the area and the channel marked for the concentration points for the actual invasion. Huge transports, tank landing ships, small troop landing craft, tankers and supply vessels of every kind plodded doggedly along under lowering skies in laboring, overheavy seas. You people at home would have been thrilled to the bone to see all these American men, American ships, and American supplies sailing calmly into the action for which they had been prepared and trained for so many months. By nightfall, we were nearing the French coast, and the watch tightened. But nothing happened, even when a full, pale moon appearing fitfully from behind the clouds gave our position away, clearly to any enemy who have been laying in wait for us. And then the fast and heavy combat ships moved up into position. All aligned themselves in the bombardment area to loose a hail of high explosives to protect the troops moving to the beaches on their landing craft. The warships started laying their smoke screen preparatory to shooting their guns. It was then only, and only a few minutes of HR, of the long-awaited D-Day. And now here's a picture on this side of the ocean. The Associated Press put a bulletin on the wires at 12:37 a.m. this morning, Eastern Wartime, saying the Germans had announced invasion landings on the French coast. Instantly, the CBS newsroom in New York sprang into action and mobilized a full invasion staff according to plan. CBS news analyst Ned Kalmer put the bulletin on the air at about 12:48, underlining the fact that it was an unconfirmed enemy statement. In both the CBS shortwave listening post and newsroom, our specialists began to monitor foreign broadcasts. At frequent intervals, CBS announcers and CBS military analyst Major George Fielding Elliott broadcast the continuing German reports, always emphasizing that it was still an enemy report unconfirmed by Allied sources. And then at a little after 3:30 this morning, we switched to SHEAF in London, where Colonel Dupuis read the first official Allied communique. One of the most interesting parts of any great story like this invasion is the way people around the world react to the first news. CBS correspondent Charles Shaw reported from London earlier this morning that he practically was town crier for the city of London, which was largely unaware in the early morning that the invasion had begun. Shaw rode through the London streets asking people what they thought of the news and found most of them hadn't heard it. But the answer of one girl when she heard the news from Shaw was typical. She said simply, "Thank God." And far removed from the thankful and hopeful spirit in Allied capitals is the only reaction so far noted from the Tokyo radio, which broadcast its first mention of the invasion, in a German language piece beamed toward Europe. The Jap broadcast said, "We have just learned with deep concern of the landings by the Allies on the coast of France. We expect they will be quickly annihilated by the courageous German army." That from Tokyo. That's the way the Japanese put it. Up to now, there's been no mention of the landings to the Japanese people themselves, according to the United States government monitors of the Office of War Information. Our correspondent, William J. Dunn, reported from Australia that invasion reports have the right-of-way on Australian radios and in the Australian headlines, but he added that there is not much external excitement. Here in our own country, reaction from coast to coast was similar. People kept on working at overnight shifts in shipyards and other factories and went to work as usual this morning. But everyone seems to be more serious, and many stopped in their tasks long enough to offer prayers for the success of the Allied effort. Perhaps most dramatic of all was the ringing of the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia's Independence Hall. The ancient bell was struck 6 times as Philadelphia's Mayor Bernard Samuel read the famous inscription, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Well, German propagandists asserted today that despite the invasion of Western Europe, life continued normal in Berlin with no excitement, no additions, no special radio announcements. But a part of these assertions, obviously, were rather false. From the time of the first landings, a constant stream of broadcasts came from the German transmitters, many of them carrying more than an indication that Hitler's defenses along the western coast had been caught napping. The German press chief was quoted by DNB as saying the Allies opened the invasion on the order of Moscow. A DNB correspondent asserted the German people is longing for revenge because of the Allied bombings of their cities. The German news agency Transocean contended in early broadcasts that it was not certain of Allied intentions, but at 1 p.m. it said, "This much has become clear by midday. These Allied landings mean this is the great invasion, and no fooling." That's the story from Germany. In a few moments, we hope again to bring you another broadcast from Britain, probably from Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. At that time, we hope to hear from several of our Columbia correspondents. We don't know exactly at what time we'll make the switch, but In a few moments, I expect that I will hear that it is time to switch to London. The warning will probably come very quickly, as you undoubtedly know if you've been with us for several hours during last night and this morning. You know how quickly the warning comes that London is ready. Meanwhile, in case you got up, let's say, a bit late and you've been filling yourself in on the invasion, you know that the German reports were the first reports, and we had 2 or 3 hours in the small hours last night before the Allied Supreme Headquarters in Britain announced that the invasion had begun, when all the news was coming from the German radio. It wasn't very much news, but it did say that the invasion had begun, and that turned out to be right. And so Elmer Davis, who, like most of us, rushed to his office in the middle of the night last night, Elmer Davis has this morning given a warning about this German radio propaganda. Mr. Davis says that despite the German accuracy in announcing the invasion before the official Allied communique came in from Supreme Headquarters in Britain, German broadcasts should not be relied on in the future. Elmer Davis said the reason the Germans made the announcement was possibly that they're trying to build up a reputation for accuracy so that they can put one over, he said, on the Allies later. And Elmer Davis asked Americans to remember that Joseph Goebbels is in business for his health and not for ours. Another brief dispatch from Supreme Headquarters just come in, just been handed me. It says, Allied Air Forces threw 11,000 aircraft of almost every type into the grand invasion of Europe today, bombing and strafing miles of Normandy's beaches and flying inland to break the enemy's communications. That's the latest detail that has come from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, that the Air Forces threw 11,000 aircraft of almost every type into the battle.
Official Washington, as might be expected, has been right on top of the invasion news ever since the German radio made the first announcement shortly after midnight, Eastern wartime. The Pentagon, the Navy building, and even the White House were all lit up like Times Square during the early morning hours. As soon as the official communique came through from General Eisenhower, officers handed out carefully prepared mimeograph statements, including one from General Black Jack Pershing, who led our forces in France in World War I. The chiefs of staff, the men responsible for our whole war effort, were on the job in the early morning hours, as were the British representatives on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Great as the invasion is, it's still only a part of the great world war for which these men are responsible. Secretary Stimson demonstrated his confidence about the invasion by remaining at home in the early morning hours of the battle for Europe. General Marshall, however, stayed at his desk the greater part of the night. Sometime before dawn, he left the Pentagon. Within 5 minutes after the first communique came from London, the OWI, through its shortwave transmitters in New York and San Francisco, was telling the world in 39 languages and dialects that the liberation of Europe was underway. There's been no opportunity as yet to get very much information out of Congress, as the congressmen are only just assembling now, and Congress takes up at noon. That was quite early. Columbia sent people around to talk to some of the boys on the street, just as Charles Shaw was on the Strand to talk to people in London. However, in spite of all that, there were other things, other happenings here. For instance, President Roosevelt went to bed last night before the news of the invasion was released, and even though he doubtless was aware of the imminence of the invasion, he slept peacefully through it and was not awakened. White House attachés, however, prepared a summary of the dispatches for him, and he's expected to discuss the invasion at his news conference this afternoon. And the colored man delivering ice at the White House this morning said, "I guess they'll be needing this today, all right." I return you now to Bob Trout in New York.
Since we went to Washington, we've had another bulletin from London here at our Columbia News headquarters in New York. The German news agency, DNB, has acknowledged a few minutes ago that Allied tanks have penetrated several miles between the towns of Caen, C-A-E-N, and Isigny on the Normandy Peninsula. DNB, the German news agency, acknowledges a penetration of a few miles by Allied tanks on the Normandy Peninsula. And now, once again, we're going to hear from Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott, who wants to tell us something of the background of naval support which our troops are receiving in the invasion. Here's Major Elliott.
You heard in broadcasts earlier in the day the bulletins announcing the that more than 640 naval guns, ranging from 4 to 16 inches in size, are bombarding the beaches and enemy strong points in support of our landing forces, and also of the work of our minesweeping force. These two forms of naval support are very important to a landing operation, and the minesweepers perhaps are even more important than the naval gunfire, because these minesweepers must get the deadly mines out of the way in order that the landing craft may approach the shore. Some mines are what are called moored mines. That is, they're mines which are moored to the bottom, to heavy anchors resting on the bottom of the sea. And these are removed by a long cable called a sweep, towed between two minesweepers, which catches the mine cable and cuts it or pulls the mine loose from its mooring. Then there are the magnetic mines, which have to be dealt with by specially prepared electric sweeps, also towed by these small minesweeping vessels. And the crews of these ships have an extremely dangerous assignment, as you can well imagine. These little minesweepers, many of them fishing boats, trawlers, belonging to the British fishing fleet in time of peace, and many of them also American ships, have carried out their work with the utmost gallantry. Now here again is Bob Trout.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. And now here is our war correspondent, Quentin Reynolds, who has a few words for us about the guns that we took ashore on the northern coast of France. Here's Quentin Reynolds.
Right now there are millions of anxious mothers and fathers in this country living through the agony of uncertainty, visualizing what their sons went through during this past long, long night. Their hearts are sick with apprehension as they think of their boys there in the hostile beaches of France. It would be presumptuous for any of us to say to these parents, stop worrying. But perhaps I could give them some information which might make them feel better. You think of your son as a youngster who until recently was not trained to combat, was not born for killing. You shudder at the thought of him fighting against the great, impersonal, frightening German war machine. But you forget that this is not only a battle of men, it is a battle of weapons. And today your son landed in France carrying the best weapons ever seen in battle. Earlier, Prime Minister Churchill spoke to the House of Commons. One sentence of his speech should bring a warm glow to the hearts of American parents whose sons are spearheading the invasion. Churchill chuckled and said, "We have a great many surprises in store for the enemy." Undoubtedly, the Prime Minister was thinking of the new, magnificent weapons which have been saved for this invasion. Weapons the like of which the world has never seen. I have seen these weapons in action in Sicily and Salerno, and I saw the newer ones tested at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. And in every case, they are immeasurably better than the German counterpart. During the first stages of the landings, our men necessarily had to depend upon their lighter weapons, the little 5-pound carbine, deadly at 300 yards, the magnificent M3 submachine gun, a lethal weapon that only weighs 8 pounds, but that can spray death more quickly than any German counterpart of it. The airborne troops mentioned so prominently in dispatches do not have to depend merely on the small arms they carry when they land. With them went our 75-millimeter pack howitzer, a gun that can be packed in 6 packages and dropped by parachute once our airborne troopers land. This tosses a heavy shell, and it tosses 6 of them a minute. By now, the big LSTs are landing our heavy mobile guns. I know you'll soon be hearing of our great 8-inch gun. I think this will be the pin-up gun of the invasion. This enormous weapon, the largest mobile gun in the world, weighs 35 tons. And it can fire one 250-pound shell per minute. And it is so accurate that it can hit a target 20 miles away. I have seen this miracle gun do this at Aberdeen. The Germans have nothing to equal it, and it can be knocked down, loaded, and sent to another spot all in 40 minutes. I could go on and tell you of our big 240-millimeter howitzer that throws a 350-pound shell 25,000 yards. Of our ever-reliable 105, of our great 120-millimeter anti-aircraft gun that can hit any German aircraft no matter how high it flies. A few weeks ago, Major General Charles T. Harris, of our Ordnance Department told me bluntly and frankly, our weapons, by every known test, are the finest weapons in the world. No one can keep you from worrying about your son, but at least remember that the odds are in his favor. He didn't land in France last night armed with a slingshot or a bow and arrow. He landed carrying the best, most devastating weapons ever made. He's got the best there is. Give a prayer of thanks to our Ordnance Department, which designed and built these weapons. They will help bring your son back safely. Now I return you to Bob Trout.
We've been listening to Columbia's war correspondent, Quentin Reynolds, here at Columbia's news headquarters in New York. Now, once again, we are going to pause for station identification. It will be a 30-second pause, but I just want to take this opportunity, if you ladies and gentlemen of our audience will bear with us, I just want to take this opportunity again to assure our staffs at our affiliated stations throughout the country that we are continuing this broadcast of our invasion coverage.
At this time, CBS World News will attempt to bring you a scheduled address to the people of France by General Charles de Gaulle, leader of the French Committee of National Liberation. General de Gaulle will speak from London, and if we are able to pick up his talk, you will hear a running translation of his address by Beverly Thurman of Columbia's shortwave news staff. This is CBS in New York, and in a few moments we will switch you to London for the scheduled address of General Charles de Gaulle. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for the general to begin, we might mention that it was announced only this morning that he had arrived in Britain. As you know, his trip to England has been planned for some time, and he is scheduled to discuss at length with Prime Minister Churchill and other leaders the problems of his committee. High on the list of subjects to be discussed, it is commonly believed, is the question of whether General de Gaulle's Committee of Liberation is to be granted full or provisional recognition as the present government of France. At the present time, the Committee of Liberation does not enjoy the recognition already granted to exile governments of other occupied nations, which now have their headquarters in London. The news bulletin this morning announcing de Gaulle's arrival in London also mentioned that he has already had a first meeting with Mr. Churchill shortly after the first news came of the invasion of his country by Allied troops. De Gaulle had apparently arrived some time before, but news of his presence in London had been held back for reasons of military security. We are still waiting for General de Gaulle to begin speaking in London. In the meanwhile, we'll bring you invasion news up to this moment. President Roosevelt summoned top Army and Navy chiefs to the White House today in Washington for an invasion conference, and he is preparing to lead the nation in a prayer, which he wrote last night as the Allied Armada moved across the English Channel to France. Mr. Roosevelt called in General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, and General Henry Arnold, Commander of the Army Air Forces. Meanwhile, reports are pouring into the White House from the War and Navy Departments on the progress of the invasion. When the invasion came early today, President Roosevelt was sound asleep, and the White House was quiet except for a message center through which came official reports of last-minute developments. The President retired early in the evening after his radio broadcast, but undoubtedly was up early canvassing the latest official dispatches. After the landing in France was announced, members of the White House staff remained in close touch with their offices, and the workday was expected to begin an hour or two earlier. Otherwise, the White House was quiet, with very few lights on, and no activity except in the press room, where a group of reporters sat through much of the night waiting for any possible development from the president. The contrast with that other climactic occasion, December 7, 1941, was marked. News of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was disseminated from the White House with, as one reporter recalled, a flash a minute. This time, the White House seemed to be sleeping through the first phases of the action. Here's a late bulletin from London which says that more than 1,000 American heavy bombers attacked enemy targets in France this morning in support of the invasion. Military observers in London said today that a general Russian offensive coordinated with the Anglo-American attack from the West may be launched within the next 48 hours, and almost certainly will begin before the weekend. News of the Allied landing in France spread swiftly throughout Russia today and touched off enthusiastic demonstrations such as rarely have been seen since the war began. American war correspondents in Moscow were the first to break the news, and they were quickly surrounded by cheering crowds who rushed to shake their hands and to offer congratulations. Radio Moscow's chief announcer, who customarily reads only Premier Stalin's orders of the day, broadcasted General Dwight D. Eisenhower's special communique announcing the landing. He read the bulletin in a solemn and triumphant tone, rivaling his best performance for the Red Army's biggest victory announcements. Soviet war marches, Yankee Doodle, and the triumphal music reserved for Stalin's victory orders followed the bulletin. For 2 weeks now, the Russian people have been expecting the invasion to begin at any moment. And the question on everyone's lips was, has it started? The Soviet people now are waiting for their own armies to strike from the east in the coordinated offensive mapped out at the Tehran Conference. The Germans' Transocean News Agency said today that a battle was in progress in the English Channel north of Le Havre between German naval units and Allied forces attempting to make a landing. Nazi broadcasters said the Allies had won footholds on several islands off the coast of France. Earlier, they reported landings in the Channel Islands west of the Norman Peninsula. That's the Normandy Peninsula. The Transocean Agency reported that a naval battle was going on in the channel north of Le Havre between German units and Allied forces trying to make a landing. DNB, the official Nazi agency, said German counterthrusts were being undertaken east of Cherbourg, but the enemy keeps throwing the bulk of his troops into the area between Cherbourg and Ustraham. The 28th and 101st American Parachute Divisions dropped in the Normandy area, DNB reported, adding the usual propaganda claim that many of these soldiers were captured. Ladies and gentlemen, this is CBS World News in New York. We had expected to bring you an address by General Charles de Gaulle speaking in London, but so far we've been unable to contact that point. Meanwhile, we're bringing you news of the invasion to bring you up to date on what has occurred in this biggest of all days, the invasion of Western Europe. An American war correspondent, Stanley Richardson, who has just returned from the Second Front beachhead with the first naval eyewitness of the operations. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're informed that we can hear from General de Gaulle in London. So we switch you now to London for the address by General de Gaulle.
1500 ans, gagner chacune de nos victoires, c'est ainsi que nous gagnerons celle-là. En bon ordre. Pour nos armées de terre, de mer, de l'air, il n'y a point là de problème. Jamais elles ne furent plus ardentes, plus habiles, plus disciplinées. L'Afrique, l'Italie, l'océan et le ciel ont vu leur force et leur gloire renaissante. La terre natale les verra demain pour la nation qui se bat.
General de Gaulle says that never have France's forces of the air, sea, and land had such a glorious opportunity to distinguish themselves. And he speaks of the glories which the French armies have just achieved in the Italian campaign.
Soit exactement suivi. La seconde est que l'action menée par nous sur les arrières de l'ennemi soit conjuguée aussi étroitement que possible avec celle que mène de front les armées alliées.
General de Gaulle says that the first order which the French government has to give to the French forces will be followed exactly.
De l'action des forces de la résistance doit durer pour aller s'amplifiant jusqu'au moment de la déroute allemande. La troisième condition est que tous ceux qui sont capables d'agir, soit par les armes, soit par les destructions, soit par le renseignement.
General de Gaulle says that the action which the French armies will carry out with the Allies against the enemy will be exactly conjugated with those of the Allies.
Ou à la déportation, quelles que soient les difficultés, tout vaut mieux.
And with these actions, that of French resistance will also be combined.
La bataille de France a commencé. Il n'y a plus dans la nation
dans l'Empire, dans les armées,
qu'une seule et même volonté, qu'une seule et même espérance, derrière le nuage.
General de Gaulle says that it is absolutely necessary that all French patriots capable to act by arms and by refusing to work for the Germans should not allow themselves to be taken prisoner.
Il vous est parvenu de Londres. Nous vous retournons au studio de la Voix de l'Amérique à New York.
And General de Gaulle said in concluding that the Battle of France has begun. And there is no longer except a single and sole will to conquer on the part of the French nation.
You have just heard a speech by General Charles de Gaulle and its translation, a running translation of that speech by Beverly Thurman of Columbia's shortwave news staff. General de Gaulle spoke to you from London. And now, here in CBS World News headquarters in New York, is Columbia's distinguished commentator, Mr. Quincy Howe.
The news of Allied landings on the north coast of France has given the war its most dramatic and sudden change since the Germans invaded Russia. Up to less than 12 hours ago, the Russians and the Russians alone had engaged and defeated millions of German troops in vast land battles. Our North African and Italian campaigns had diverted some German strength from Russia, so had our preparations for invasion from the West. The fall of Mussolini in July and the fall of Rome day before yesterday hit German prestige hard throughout Europe. But until Anglo-American troops began to land in force in the West, it was toward the Russians that the Germans looked with fear and the people of the occupied countries with hope. Our landings have started to change all that, and the better and faster our campaign in the West develops, the more rapidly British and American prestige will grow in Western Europe. These landings differ from the invasion of Italy in at least two important respects. First, they show that Britain and the United States have developed first-rate military power on land as well as in the sea and on the air. We are now able to come to grips with the Germans in their own element, land fighting, and have already mastered our two elements, the air and the sea.
That was Columbia's analyst, Quincy Howe.